It's not just the data. I believe it's 80-20. That's just, it's not scientific. I believe there is a lot of value in data, but that by itself is not gonna swing it. I think the 20% difference is you also assessing the current situation, the current mindset, the current energy of the individual, the current situation, the strengths of the skill sets, and you'll figure it out. But
that was Ron Carr. This is Tom Fox, and I'd like to welcome you to the FCPA Compliance Report. Today I visit with Ron about his lifelong journey in sales, retailing, and business consulting. He's developed a great set of skills around leadership, influence, persuasion, and trust. We talk about the velocity mindset, how important it is, and how you can bring that to your organization. First, a word from this month's sponsor, Ethico.
To a chance for improvement. Imagine a workspace where efficiency and compliance coexist harmoniously. Don't just dream of faster resolutions, make it your reality. Visit ethico.com/CPN today to book a demo and dive into our exclusive white paper by Tom Fox, the ROI of compliance, and to try our free ROI calculator. Empower your team with the tools they deserve.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox back for another episode, and you are in for a treat today. Why? Because I'm in for a treat today. Because I have Ron Carr with me. Ron, first of all, welcome, and thank you so much for taking the time to visit with me today.
Oh, Tom, thank you. It's a pleasure. I've been looking forward to this time together.
So we're going to have a pretty wide-ranging conversation. Ron is about as polymath in several topics as someone I've come across. I've been looking forward to this. So could you tell us a little bit about your professional background? Oh, first of all, it's nice to talk to someone my own age. So there. So could you tell us a little bit about your professional background?
Sure. So I graduated college in 1978 and I couldn't get a sales job to save my life because I had no experience. So I had to settle on a retail position, H.L. Green, as the assistant store manager. I learned some retail for a couple of years and then got a sales job and started selling copiers. And that was my school of hard knocks. Did well, learned what really sales was all about, not what they taught you. And then stayed in the computer industry for the next 10 years. And then after that, went into my own consulting, speaking, and coaching business that's been going on for the last 33 years.
You have written a book called The Velocity Mindset. Actually, turn your vision into reality with a velocity mindset. And you start off by posing the question, which I thought was brilliant, which is, why should you have a board meeting with yourself?
Right.
Tell us about that.
It all goes back to, if things are not going the way you want to, why do you keep doing the same thing over and over? The rule of insanity. So my first job was selling copiers. Now, I was seduced into that job because it was the first plain bond copier they had. So they were telling me, look how sexy it is. It doesn't mess your clothes up. It prints clear pictures. I said, great. How fast is it? 15 copies a minute. Collate? Not yet. Duplicate? Not yet. All it does is 15 copies a minute, even though it's perfect. Yes. I got seduced. I decided I'd go sell it. I couldn't. Every time I walked in a door, the first thing the office manager would ask me is, how is it compared to the big Xerox machine on the third floor? Does it duplicate? Not yet. Does it collate? Not yet. But when it does, come back. After the door hitting me in the rear end quite a few times in the first 2 months and not selling a dime, I decided to have the board meeting. Who is the board meeting in New Jersey? It's you, yourself, and I. Me, myself, and I. And where do we go? We go to a diner. So we sat down in the diner, the three of us, and I'm asking myself the question. I said, what's going on? And I said, well, you're trying to have this conversation and no one's buying it. I said, so what are you selling? You selling a copier? And I thought about it and I said, not really. I'm really selling a communication vehicle. And I said, why don't we just start talking about that? So on my next call, Tom, I went in, an office manager said, what's up? And I said, would you agree with me that a copier is nothing more than a communication vehicle? She goes, absolutely. I said, when it comes to that, what are your three biggest challenges? Tom, it was like I was a therapist and she was laying on my couch. Can we talk? And she starts going into how for Sally or Bob on the first floor to make one single copy, they got to walk all the way to the staircase, but that's after they chit-chat with everybody along the way. They go upstairs to the third floor. Then they have to wait online behind all these big behemoth jobs to make one copy. By the time they come back and chit-chat again, I said, how long is that excursion? She goes, try 2 hours. And I said, how often does it happen? She goes, try the equivalent of 2 full-time employees. And I looked at her and I said, how would you like them back? And she goes, how are you going to get them back for me? And I said, look, I'm not here to compete against that machine on the third floor. It's a great machine. I'm here to fill in your gaps. I'm here to give you 3 machines, 1 for every floor, for those 1, 2, and 3 copies so your people can make them immediately and you can get those 2 full-time employees back. And she bought 3 machines that day. So the board meeting is real simple. It's really, it's like a metaphor. Take yourself someplace where you're not in the stress of the job. Look at it for what it really is on all sides and ask yourself this one question. What can I do differently? Tom, one thing I say to all my audiences, whether I'm speaking to sales groups or leaders, I say that you're all leaders. Anytime you're trying to influence somebody, you're a leader. And the one thing a leader does when something doesn't go the way they want it to, before they blame anybody else or anything else, they first ask themselves this one question. What could I do differently? A lot of people would have blamed Royal Business Machines. They didn't have the collator. They didn't have the duplicator. Okay, what was that going to do for me? It wasn't going to make me a commission. It wasn't going to help me. So I lived what I talk about. If I asked myself, what could I be doing differently? And that's the concept of a board meeting.
So I will share with you one of the reasons I was so excited to visit with you today is a similar type of journey. Many of my audience are corporate compliance professionals, and they think I have this or that policy, I communicate this way, but I don't have any customers. Guess what? Their customers are employees.
Right.
And if you can make the mindset shift to what does the customer want instead of what does my employee want, then it opens up an entire new world. And you really illustrated that perfectly with your example of having a board meeting with yourself. What is the art of the pause and how do you practice it?
The board meeting is an art and a pause. It's basically pausing yourself and something's not going right. See, let's talk about velocity for a second, because I think that really has to come into play here. What is velocity? And when you think of the word velocity, Tom, what's the first word that comes to your mind?
Speed.
Yep, that's what everybody does. Speed, motion, movement. But if that's all you think about, then you don't have velocity. In many cases, you'll have burnout. How many times do we go rifling through our to-do lists and we get through all the things at the end of the day where we're exhausted and then we're disappointed because we never moved the needle forward? The problem today is everybody's so worried about their to-do list and they're not worried about purpose. Purpose, what you're trying to achieve, is what drives your actions. So I was invited to speak to the Protocol Association, which is also about compliance. And they were talking about how do we get people or these big dignitaries to follow the protocols. And I said, the problem is you're just communicating a set of protocols without any context to what's important to that person. And influence, there's two parts to the human body you got to think about, the heart and the mind. The mind is when we compare things to see if we're making the right decision. The heart is where we get emotionally connected. Most people start with the mind first to see if there's a need. But people are not listening if you go there first. They'll only listen to you if you create the emotional connection first. Then when you give them the information, they're listening to you now. That's what I did with the copier situation. I went in and I found out where was she trying to go and what was her biggest issue with this. And it was wasting too much time. And then I presented it, not about how crisp the copies were, not about how it was a brand new machine. I only talked about it in context, how she was going to get back those 2 full-time employees. So whether it's compliance or anything, people are going to do what they do based on what they think is going to help them or help them avoid pain. And if you don't have a story that can link how your compliance issue is going to make their jobs easier, or it's going to help them save time or whatever it is, they're probably not going to be paying too much attention to you.
Ron, you mentioned influence, and in many ways, that's all a compliance professional has, is the ability to influence. How do you see the neuroscience of influence, and why is it so critical to your thoughts?
I stumbled on that, Tom. I was doing a project for a well-known financial services company, and it was around the early 2000s. And this company was written up in Harvard Business Review. They knew their market. They knew who their best client was. It was the conservative investor. Why? Because their offices were one-person offices. So they needed a conservative investor to come in, do a strategy with the advisor, but then leave the advisor alone for a quarter, come back in a quarter, don't do day trading because the advisor wouldn't have time to do all those transactions. So they knew who the market was. And then they also knew the numbers. They knew it took them 5 calls to close a new investor. So they brought me in and they said, can you help us, you know, reduce that sales cycle? So when I went on and they would cold call because the market was retirees. So I flew to Chicago and we're cold calling outside Chicago. The investor, the advisor was in the business 4 years, comes in, elderly couple, very nice Midwestern. They open the door. He spends 12 minutes building the social relationship about the Chicago Bears loss, about the kids' pictures, the grandkids, all these things. And I can see their eyes wandering. What are you here for? Even though they wouldn't say it. So at the end, then he makes the biggest rookie mistake. And he goes, when it comes to stocks and bonds, what are you doing? And why would you ask that? They probably have an advisor ready. I teach people, don't compete, create. So I took him out after we were done and we didn't get anywhere in that call. And I said, look, cut the chit-chat to 1 minute and then ask this one question. I know you probably got a financial advisor. That's not why I'm here. The question I have to ask you is, when it comes to your future, what are the 3 things you need your money to provide for you? When he asked that question in the call, I noticed that, well, I'm going to ask you this question, Tom. And I don't know if you're going to have video with your podcast, but just pretend there's 2,000 people looking at you now, or 200,000. I'm sorry, you have a big audience. So, Tom, here we go, okay? What are the 3 things you need your money to provide for you in the future?
My wife.
Stop. Your eyes just went to the left. There was a change in your brain chemistry at that time. You were no longer thinking about whether or not I'm trying to sell you something. You immediately went into your life thinking about what was important. Is that fair?
Yes.
And when you did that, what changed inside of you?
I thought about the person I was referring to and how much I love her.
Okay. And you were no longer thinking that I was trying to sell you anything.
I wasn't thinking about that at all. I was thinking about the goal that you asked me to articulate.
And you were going to share with me what you have. And it would be heard this time because I'm going to articulate it back to you in context to what was important to you. I saw that happening. And you go by results. Anyway, the results were they gave him the 3 things that he needed, and he had a conversation. In fact, it worked so fast that they had a class in that week. And they asked me to do a 1-hour closing at the end of one day, and I did. And that night at 11 o'clock, a 4-to-7-year veteran called me up. We're in the same hotel. He says, sorry to bother you, but I used what you said, and I called up 2 widows who I've been working on for 6 months, who both had $100,000, but I couldn't get them to pull the trigger. I said, what happened? He said, I called both of them, and I said, I was remiss. I was only talking about stocks and bonds, and I never asked you the most important question. And they said, what is it when it comes to your future? What are the 3 things you need your money to provide for you? He said he got into 2 different conversations immediately that he never had before. One committed their funds to him that night on the phone, and the other gave him another appointment. That's how significant it is. So here's what happens. The cortisol is the fight or flight hormone, right? We have to manage our client's cortisol or the employee's cortisol we're trying to influence. All right. If it's too high, they're not listening because they're stressed out. If it's too low, they're comatose. They're not upset, but they're not really interested. If you have a scale 0 to 10, with 10 being the highest cortisol and 0 being the lowest, you want people in the 3 to 5 range. They're active, they're engaged, and they want to move forward. If someone's 1 to 2, they're not really listening because there's nothing really bothering them or it's not really hitting them. But one thing I teach my audiences, whether you're in compliance or whatever, it's not enough just to go in with a good game plan. The first thing you have to do is create the safe environment for someone to listen to you. In other words, think ahead. So if you're, let's say, a salesperson calling somebody, making a cold call, you will know you're an interruption in someone's day. Heck, even if I had an appointment with you, Tom, and I came in, and if you're in the middle of 10 alligators that day, I'm still an interruption to you. So automatically, when we start the call in that situation, our cortisol is going to be a 6, 7, or an 8. It's not in the ideal range. If you're going to an employee and you're going to start talking about compliance issues and why they have to follow without anything about them, they're already saying, oh, here comes the compliance officer. The cortisol goes up and they're not in a position to listen. So the first thing we have to do is bring the cortisol down to where it's engaged. And how do you do it? By asking them what they're trying to achieve, what's important to them. That's how you do that. Now, when you do that and you change that blood chemistry immediately, like you felt when I asked you, what are you trying to achieve? Then you start giving me information. Would you give me any information if you didn't trust me?
Maybe,
but probably not, right? Or not enough. But yet most people give the three things they're looking for. Why? Because when you move the conversation from you, which is self-focus, to them, they are now worrying about you trying to put something over them. They're talking about something that they want to talk about, and they'll start giving you information. They start trusting you. Oxytocin is the trust hormone. Now, trust is earned. It takes a long time to really develop trust. But even in a conversation with someone you don't know, you better have the inklings of developing it in the first couple of seconds. Otherwise, they're not going to give you anything. And the best way to do that, have them talk about themselves and where they're trying to go. And when I asked you to go about, and what were the three things, did you feel better about having that conversation with me?
Absolutely.
So now you're feeling better. So now your dopamine's being released and you're feeling good about the whole thing. And the dopamine only rides with the oxytocin. You won't feel good unless you're feeling trust. And you won't get any of those two if you're not managing the cortisol, both yours and the person you're trying to influence effectively.
So we live, in many ways, a data-driven society.
Mm-hmm.
We both grew up professionally at a time where you were told to trust your gut. Are those two mutually exclusive, or is intuition something that still should be a part of a leader, of a professional, or really anyone in business?
I had a speaker. I was president of the National Speakers Association, and I was also president of the New York chapter. And when I joined the New York chapter in the 90s, we had an intuition expert, and she was talking one day, and I said, Nancy, what poo stuff is this? Because I came from corporate America. But Tom, I got to tell you, over the years, I'm a believer. Intuition, because I studied it. What is intuition? Intuition is nothing more than your subconscious, all your past experiences, all your biases, all your needs, wants, all the things you're willing to do, all the things you're not willing to do, all the things you know about yourself. And so when I'm having trouble making a decision, intuition you should feel here. In other words, if you're acting on your intuition and you're thinking more than a couple of seconds, you're here. You're not in your mind. You're not in your intuition. Your intuition's down by your chest. So if you concentrate on your chest, and I'll have you do it, okay? Let's suppose you're buying a new car, okay? And I don't know what your favorite color is. I don't want to know, but let's suppose you have two colors to choose from, right? Green and red, right? So the first thing you'd say is, okay, how does green strike me in the chest? So you just go down here. Do I feel anything? And then quickly, How does red strike me? And which one struck you? That's the intuition talking to you.
Okay.
And so I do that test. And whichever one I feel is jazzing me or pushing me or giving me some kind of sensation, I know that's the one I should be doing.
So how do you pair that with the data and data analytics we're all supposed to?
I got to tell you, that's a great question. And that's the age-old question we're all facing now of analytics in sports. Think about that. You got the fight in analytics. The analytics people want all decisions made 100% on that. And then you got the old-time baseball player managers saying, but wait a minute, you got to take into account who's on that day, who's not, who's in a different space and whatever. It's not just the data. I believe it's 80-20. It's not scientific. I believe there is a lot of value in data, but that by itself is not going to swing it. I think the 20% difference is you also assessing the current situation, the current mindset, the current energy of the individual, the current situation, the strengths of the skill sets, and you'll figure it out. But yeah, it's not just data. There was a movie called The Beautiful Mind, if you remember it, about a guy, the professor at Princeton, who I forgot his name, but he got a Nobel Prize for math. And he had a great line. It was something along the lines like when he said, math will solve 80% of the problems. That's the analytics. The data will tell you all you need to know. But what I'm saying is it's not just data. When you bring human beings involved, you got to bring the emotional needs involved. And if you're not addressing those and helping them get to where they want to be, no matter what the data says, there's a good shot they're not going to do it.
Ron, can we turn to your book, A Velocity Mindset? You've talked about the mindset a little bit, but how do you see a business, company, an organization, or even the broader world would look if everyone had a velocity mindset?
If we take velocity as being speed with direction, it's the direction that's driving us. It's our goals. It's whatever we want to achieve that's driving our actions, okay? So if we look at that in form of velocity, the one thing that I tell people is that if something's not working, just stick to that one question, what can I do differently? You have to change the winds a little bit, if you will, to get to a different location, because if what you're doing is stalling you, it is not helping you. So when you are dealing with velocity, and I'm sorry, I was just going to a different point. Give me that last question one more time.
So what would it look like? What would a company
look
like?
Oh, yeah,
like?
Yeah.
What would society look like?
I got it, yes. One of the things I keep saying to the audience is, what would the world look like if everybody acted like a leader and not a victim of circumstance? That's what I'm after. And what I'm after is before anybody starts blaming anybody else or anything else, what could I do differently next time? If we are all asking ourselves that question on everything we're doing, wouldn't the world be a better place?
I certainly think so. What are some of the self-imposed limitations that drag one's velocity down, Ron?
Yeah, and it's not outside obstacles. It's internal obstacles that drag our velocity. The number one thing is our stories. Now, stories are great. Stories sell, and stories are emotionally based. If a story is helping push you forward, great, keep it in your head. But if it's not, then change it. And the good news is, if the story is not serving you well, guess what? Whoever wrote it can change it, and you're the one who wrote it. It's that simple. But people don't think it is. So whenever someone says something to you, Tom, or someone does something to you, not you personally, but all of us, are immediately creating a story as to what that means. And most often, what we think it means is not what it was intended to be. And that's why we don't have effective communications with each other. So the question you have to ask yourself is, like, for example, a common thing is, person's not calling me back. We're all creating a story. They're not interested. Why wouldn't they call me back? I call them back. Don't they? Why are they making me wait? And these are all stories. How is that helping you? And is it moving you forward? The answer is probably not, because it's making you angry or it's making you fearful or whatever. And it's not allowing you, if the person's not calling, to maybe make a phone call and say, hey, I understand that I haven't heard from you. Just need to know if you have any more questions or you just need more time. But you're not going to make that call like that and sound confident, because the stories of the fear of loss or whatever you're going through is preventing you from doing that. You have to monitor the self stories. And like I said, if it's pushing you, great. But if it's not, rewrite it.
So how does the art of the pause help someone increase their velocity?
Because that's the tool to rewrite your story, like I did with the copier. I had that board meeting with myself. I got myself out of the way of fire. I wasn't in the office. I was having a nice calming conversation, not blaming myself. And I said, okay, maybe I got to change the conversation on the outcomes. Maybe I'm not selling a copier. Let's try communication. Maybe I'll have more to talk about then. And I tried it. You never know if it's going to work. You try things. We fail, Tom, more often than we succeed in life. Think about this. Are you a baseball fan?
I am a huge Houston Astro, two-time world champions over the past 5 years, baseball fan.
Okay. I'm a huge 26-time world champion New York Yankees. Now, okay. I'm a Yankee fan. So now we got that cleared up. If anybody on the Astros or the Yankees is batting 300, how much are they making? What's the size of their contract?
Depends on how long they've been in the league.
Let's say it's their lifetime average, and they've been in the league 5 years.
Well, they're making $30
million. 30? No.
30. A year.
A year. So it's usually 5 years, like $150 million. All right. Think about what they got paid for. To bat 300, which means out of every 10 at-bats, you can strike out miserably 7 times, get 3 singles or a home run, and make multi-millions of dollars. We don't get penalized for what we lose. We get rewarded for what we gain. So don't let your members get upset, because once the emotion comes in and it's a story, if it's not a good emotion, it can hold you back. Don't let them get upset because someone didn't follow a protocol or a directive from a compliance. Just let them go back and attack it from a different position and just say, hey, what's important to you? What are you trying to solve and what you're trying to do? And then see if there's a way to link the compliance issue with what they're trying to do. And they'll go a lot further.
So where or how does velocity relate to two current workplace issues? Number one, working from home or a hybrid work. But the other thing is, you and I are part of the baby boomer generation. We're part of one of 5 different generations in the workplace. How does velocity work on those two topics? The work from home, hybrid work, not in the office everyday environment, and the 5 different generations in the workplace.
Okay. The hybrid from home is forcing people to do what I've been preaching for the last 30 years to managers. Don't micromanage tasks. Manage the results. Usually what happens, especially in sales, a top performing person gets into a manager's role and they force everybody to do it the way they did because they work that way. First of all, there's different personalities. Not everything works the same way for everybody else. And also not everybody's interested in the same way. It's not about them doing the task the way you did it. It's you managing the results. And if the results are not the way that they need to be, ask the person to start thinking about how they think about it, what could they think differently, and what can they do differently. If you keep telling them and you don't have them think it out, they'll never think it out on their own, and they're always going to be dependent on you for success. All right? So manage the results, not the tasks, especially in a hybrid. What was the second one again?
You actually may have answered it. And it's the following. We now have the
different generations, yes.
Yeah, 5 different generations. Does that same answer work?
It does, but you have to modify it a little bit. I am 67. I like to talk to people and see them. All right? The young generation today, the 22-year-olds, they don't even want to talk to you. They don't want to see you. they want a text. And the struggle I have is how do you have a conversation back and forth in a text where you can get your points across? But you learn because that's the only way they're going to communicate. Now, it's not the same for everybody. We can't make it black and white. Every 20-year-old only texts. That's not true. Okay? Everybody's got their own different ways. But if you're communicating in a certain way to somebody and it's not working, try it a different way. Like, I got a guy who's a baby boomer. I tried calling him a couple of times. We're good friends. He hasn't responded. I sent him a message on Facebook and he responded in a second. So find out where your clientele or the employees hang out, how they usually communicate. And if you got something important to communicate with them, communicate it in that fashion.
It's like my daughter is 27, and I said, honey, why don't you ever call me? She said, Dad, what's a phone? If you want to get me, text me. And it's the exact same thing.
Yeah, I have a 29-year-old. It's the same thing.
Ron, unfortunately, we are near the end of our time for this show. But before we leave, I wanted to ask you about your experience with the National Speakers Association and your presidency and why you think it's such a great organization.
I can honestly say that every success that I've had in the speaking consulting business came from NSA because of the great ideas that I've learned from my colleagues, best practices, and just the fellowship, because you're in this business for the most part alone, unless you have some staff, and it's easy to get into a myopic viewpoint. And I think if you're a member of NSA for a while, the sessions are amazing, but now, for me, most of my value comes in the hallway conversations with my peers, if you and I meet each other and we're talking. So it's an amazing, when I was in corporate America, I used it like my national sales meeting to go and get revved up, but also to learn best practices and learn how to slay the dragon a little better. Remember one thing in terms of velocity. You can only go so far and so fast through the efforts of yourself. But you can go a heck of a lot farther and faster through the efforts of others. Networking and leveraging is what it's about, and that's what NSA does a great job in offering.
Ron, before we leave, if our listeners wanted any more information on the Velocity Mindset, your consulting services, or to connect with you, what would be the best place for them to buy the book and the best ways to connect with you and or your consulting practice?
Sure. They can look up Amazon, The Velocity Mindset. We have 92 reviews already on the book. And if my website is Ron Carr, that's RONKARR.com. And if they want to give me a buzz directly, they can reach me at 201-914-3895. I just gave you my cell phone number.
Ron, I wanted to thank you again. This has been great fun. I hope we can continue this conversation.
Thank you.
This is Tom Fox again. As I mentioned at the start of this episode, our network sponsor for this month is Ethoco. I have partnered with Ethoco to help you figure out the ROI of your compliance program. I've written a white paper on that that's available at the website listed in the show notes. And Ethoco has developed an ROI calculator to help you determine the ROI of your compliance program. I hope you will check out both of these items this month. This is Tom Fox again. We've linked to the article that we referenced in this podcast in the show notes, so check it out, as well as an additional article by my podcast guest. The FCPA Compliance Report is a special production of the Compliance Podcast Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.